So the irony of it was that having auditioned for whoever I auditioned for at RADA and they'd said yes, I then had to go to a church hall in Rotherham on a Saturday afternoon and audition for a woman who looked like she was out of something and Murder, She Wrote. Sat behind a desk, literally in the middle of a church hall. And I went in and I did the same two speeches I'd done for RADA. She said I wasn't good enough.
Hello, good afternoon. Wonderful, perfectly formed, ever so slightly, yes, intimate audience today. Welcome to Off the Record. I'm your host, Steve Bradley, and this time we are turning the tables on our guest speaker. Very successful actor, writer and director with a career spanning over 35 years, so we're going to pick his brains. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Paul Clayton. How does it feel being in the other chair?
It's a bit frightening, actually.
Is it?
Yeah. It's a bit odd, sitting on this side, but you're going to make it easier, aren't you?
I'll be kind. I'll be gentle. All right. So, I'm going to start off exactly the same way you start off.
Okay.
Take a leaf out of your book. So, when was the seed sown for you? Where was it planted? When did you decide, I want to be an actor?
I don't know whether there was a moment of deciding that's what I wanted to do, because I can't remember ever wanting to do anything else. But I do remember doing a play in infant school, in the last year of infant school. So I would have been 6, 7, before you went. They're different. I don't know what the things are now, year 2, year 3 or whatever. I remember playing a soldier, and there was a witch in it and a woman with a baby. We put it together. It wasn't a script, you know. I think we rehearsed it in the playground.
You devised it yourself.
Yeah, and I was pushing the envelope then, because I think it took me about 20 years before I played a soldier again. So it was very brave as a 6, 7-year-old to go and do. And it was called Evil Spirits. And I remember our teacher was called Miss Woodcock, and all the chairs were pushed back on a Friday afternoon to create a semicircle, and we did it in the semicircle. And it might have lasted 3 minutes, 4 minutes. I'm sure in my mind it lasted hours. But I do remember that, and then I remember that being an ongoing thing through school, that whenever I could, we'd do plays, and normally we had to instigate them. At grammar school, I went to an old-fashioned red brick grammar school in Yorkshire, and where in the sixth form we wore fabulous maroon gowns if we were head boy or counsellor or whatever. But drama, no, that's what people who weren't very brainy did.
Really?
If you were clever, you did history, you did sport and football, rugby, hockey, and if you were CSE material, oh yes, they can go and do drama.
So you very much had to instigate your own kind of enjoyment.
A lot of it. I mean, we did a school play. Every Christmas we did a school play. And every March we did a Gilbert and Sullivan opera, which was staff and pupils. Funnily enough, staff playing the principals, pupils in the chorus.
Of course.
Drama wasn't something that... And the school really actively pushed me to do something other than drama as a career. So I think for about 3 weeks I harboured the idea of being a journalist.
Right.
Because I used to like to write. And they pushed me to go to Oxbridge. And it was never explained to me that Oxbridge would have been a really good choice for an actor. It was just, no, you know, you should go because you're going to do really well in your A-levels. And being a teenager, I just rebelled and went, no, I'm going to drama school. That's what I want to do. So they stopped pushing me for Oxbridge. They gave up on me a little bit. And I went to the National Youth Theatre, and then I went back and I worked really hard, and I got really top A-level results, which I picked up, and then just went to the school and went to drama school.
Did you grow up in a theatrical household?
No. So, I grew up in a shop.
Did you?
My grandparents had a shop. They had two village shops that were side by side. One was an off-licence and one was general stores, everything from tea bags to Tampax. And they had a connecting door, so you could go through them behind the counter, but they were separate shops because the general store had to close at 6 and the off-licence opened for licensing hours. And we had beer pumps, so people came across the village green with jugs. It's grim up north. No, really. People came across the village green with jugs, and they bring their jug before their whatever the equivalent of the X Factor was on a Saturday night. And I remember when I was about 4, my granddad used to pick me up and balance me on the edge of the beer tray, and I put both hands on the top of the pump, and then if I let myself go, my whole body weight could then just pull a pint of Bentley's bitter.
Sounds safe.
So that, yeah, my parents had no. I don't think they, you know, they knew I liked to act, but they had no inkling of the world. And I think that's the thing that you know, drama school did, was that where is the bridge from somebody who has that background, a little mining village in the Soviet Socialist Republic of South Yorkshire, where do you have a way of getting into, you know, we didn't have the internet, there was one tatty leaflet in the careers department at school, marked careers in drama, and evidently the careers in drama are all to do with teaching. So there was no, you know, there was no way into the world. That's what drama school did, really. It helped give me that bridge.
So where did you go for training? Where did you go to drama school?
I went to Manchester Poly. Because I went to RADA, because that was the only RADA drama school you've heard of. And I was offered a place at RADA. And then I found out that my parents weren't as rich as I thought they were. I thought we had a shop, you know, we did everything. But no, because they didn't have enough money to pay for me to go to RADA. So it was going to be a grant. And in those days, you got a discretionary grant for places like RADA. So the irony of it was that having auditioned for whoever I auditioned for at RADA, and they'd said yes, I then had to go to a church hall in Rotherham on a Saturday afternoon and audition for a woman who looked like she was out of something and Murder She Wrote, sat behind a desk, literally in the middle of a church hall. And I went in and I did the same two speeches I'd done for RADA, and she said I wasn't good enough. And I wasn't good enough to get a discretionary grant. So I've never, ever, ever managed to track her down. So I had to go to a place that you got a mandatory grant for. And the only place at that time that was on the National Conference of Drama Schools that required A-levels, or that you could have A-level, was Manchester Poly, because it was part of the Polytechnic. Mm. So I applied there, was offered a place, and if I got 2 A-levels, I would automatically get a grant, which I did, and that's why I went to Manchester, which actually turned out to be good in the end.
Yes, yeah, so tell me about drama school. How was that for you? Was it completely, like, you felt at home there, and was it good training for you? How long was it, 2 years or three?
3 years. 3 years. It's a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was good. I think I did look back on it very fondly. And I did some nice things, and I do think it changed who I was and what I was as an actor, or it made me more confident, I think. I did the National Youth Theatre simultaneously, and so every summer I was coming to London and appearing in plays in London and rehearsing with with Tim Spall and Kate Boffrey and Alex Jennings and people. And then you went back to drama school, which was slightly different. Because at drama school, because for the first year, because they strip you down, then they break you down, yeah. They don't let you act, they take it away from you, and then they build it back up. And I was a bit reluctant to let it go, I think, yeah. In the first year. No, actually, this is what I do.
Do you think that's a good approach to take when someone's that eager to go to drama school and learn, and then they strip it away from you? Do you think that was a good thing?
Well, I think stripping it away is good, because it's like what you do with actors in a rehearsal room, isn't it? But you do expect actors in a rehearsal room to bring something to you. When I'm director, you think, I want to see what you'd like to do with it. I don't want to tell you everything. I want to see what you'd like to do with it. and then I'll help you build that and shape it into what I see as a whole. And I think that stripping it all away, sometimes it can really affect people's confidence. We have one guy who'd been a really good television director in the 60s, and he'd done lots of really famous 60s dramas and a lot of live television. And now he was on the booze, and he worked at Manchester Poly Drama School on the TV course, because they had a school of film and television. And he did these sessions where it seemed to me his objective was just to make you cry.
Really?
So you sat on a chair, and he'd ask these questions, and it was about you and whatever. It was evidently it was successful when you cry. And I remember doing it and just faking the crying, thinking, I don't want to go through half an hour. I remember watching Amanda Burton do it, and it, you know, she's a tough cookie, Amanda. And it took him about 45 minutes before she said, you know. And I thought, I can't be fucked with that. You know, so I did about 8 minutes, and they were, yeah, it was terrible. And he was absolutely taken in by it, you know. And he went, no, that's great, and now we're going to... And I thought, oh, this is such shit. So I'm a bit wary about that.
Do you think training... This is a question you ask all your guests. Do you think training's necessary or important now for actors? Do you think training, going to drama school, do you think it's important?
Well, I think it's important, and I think acting is a craft. I don't think acting is an art. I think we make art with directors and other actors and writers. We create art, but I don't think acting itself is an art. I think it's a craft. Mm. I think it's a job. And I think you can hone it with skills. And, you know, you wouldn't dream of letting somebody loose as a plumber without any training, would you? Mm-hmm. You know, there's a sink, fix it. So why would you let somebody loose as an actor without any training? Mm. But I do think that it needs reassessing now, because I think we're in a 3-year training thing, because that's what universities did for degrees. So that's how funding was done in the 60s and the 70s. People got funding for university, people got funding for drama school. We'll match them, 3 years. And now, of course, 3 years is a massive investment for somebody to go to drama school. No way I would have been able to do it. And I don't know whether you do need 3 years. I mean, interestingly enough, RADA always used to be 8 terms, which of course was 2 and a bit years. So they got their people out earlier than the other drama schools. Mm. But I think it provides a bridge. I think it provides a way into the world of work. And it gives you contacts and it gives you an approach. And I do think it allows you to make mistakes. I mean, I don't think I did anything that was fundamentally different from how I used to act at school until possibly halfway through my 3rd year at drama school. And then suddenly I went, oh, right. Hmm.
So you come out of drama school.
Yeah.
What's your first major job, your first big job?
This is really awkward because I was really lucky. So I worked with lots of graduates here from the Alan Bates and about that thing about coming out. And that's at drama school.
That's another story.
That's sort of coming out. And about how you approach the world of work. And actually, I know bugger all about it personally, because I was at drama school. I was thinking something will happen. I was having that resolute faith. And 4 days before we finished, and so we were busy planning the last night of drama school mega party, you know, with the awards and the anarchy that goes with leaving 3 years at a place of education. The assistant director from the Royal Exchange in Manchester pulled up in his rather flash red sports car in the car park, and I was walking across the car park, and he went, you're the person I've come to see. And I went, oh right, okay. And I'd worked with him, he'd done a play in our final year, and he gave me an envelope, and I opened the envelope in the car park, and it was an offer to do a tour of The Winter's Tale, starting in 4 weeks' time, going all around Europe, and then coming back to the Royal Exchange for 8 weeks. And I thought it was a wind-up. And I can't remember. I sort of handed it back and went, yeah, and... And he went, no, it's a... You know, and I remember having to ask if I could use a phone in the office at drama school to ring Sophie Marshall, who was the casting director, and go, I've got your letter. And I do remember my hand shaking. And I was going to be paid £68 a week, which was a fortune. And we went to Germany and Belgium, Luxembourg, Switzerland, Hungary, Romania, which was still behind the Iron Curtain. And then we came back and we re-rehearsed in the round and did 2 months in Manchester. So I left drama school, I had 4 weeks off, and then I went back and started that. And it was luck. You know, they'd seen our showcase. The theatre was building relationships with the drama school. The theatre had only been open 2 years. And I think they felt it would be politic to offer somebody something. So I did that, and I brought the Oracle back from Delphi every night. But the best thing about it was I met a wonderful actress doing that who was incredibly far-seeing in her knowledge, that we did the rehearsal. So I came to London. We were rehearsing in London. We were in a church hall in Warwick Avenue, sat round, probably the most frightening thing you do in your life. They never get easier, doing read-throughs and that first morning, and you go and you look at everybody else. There were all these people, because it's the first time you're going to act with people who are not your age. At drama school, everybody's your age. We have one older actress who was doing it after her kids had grown up, but otherwise, we're all the same age. Here, there are men in their 60s and their 70s playing men in their 60s and 70s, and we read The Winter's Tale. We just read it straight through. Then we had a coffee break, and I remember going into the kitchen to make my cup of coffee. And a wonderful actress, and I don't know whether anybody would know, but she was with Olivier and things at the Old Vic in the 50s, called Dilys Hamlet. She's not with us anymore. And in this production, your name was either above the title or you weren't on the poster. And she was above the title, and of course I wasn't on the poster. And she came up to me, and I'm making my cup of coffee, and she went, I just thought your reading was lovely. And I went, oh, thank you very much. That's really nice. And you're in that, you know, post-drama school. And she went, yes, no, excellent, excellent. And I thought, oh, well, yeah, it is, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
And then she went, do you know, when you're 40, you'll never stop. And I went, thank you. Doing a quick calculation, I was then 21, and that meant 19 years of waiting time. She was absolutely right. Because
really?
Anything I've had regarding a career... I mean, I had nice jobs, but I don't think I did anything that was notable or anything till I grew up into who I was at 40.
So when was the first... When was the time where it did really kick off then? When did you get the bigger job which started to get you? Because you transitioned from theatre to TV as well, didn't you?
Yeah, I did a lot of theatre because that's what you did in those days. I mean, I know talking to Imelda Staunton a couple of weeks ago, and we were in rep together, and that's what you did. There was a sort of ordered pattern then. You left drama school, you wrote to lots of rep theatres, you went and worked in rep theatre. I did 4 years in reps without an agent, and then eventually I got an agent. And then I went to the RSC for 3.5 years, and then I came out of it. So there was no need to think about doing telly. And I did some bits and bobs of telly. And then I took a lot of time off in the 90s to be a director, which is something I'd always wanted to do. And I gave up acting. I didn't give it up, but people kept coming up and going, oh, you direct now, don't you? And I went, yeah, yeah. And they wanted to pigeonhole you.
Right.
So you direct now, so we don't have to think about you doing acting. So I didn't get any acting work for about 6 years. And then one of my shows left Greenwich on a national tour, and the producers wanted me to take over from somebody who wasn't doing the tour so that I could be with the tour. And we came to Richmond. And there were lots of young guys in the cast who were really good, and they'd invited lots of casting directors. In fact, funnily enough, and I was playing the Sergeant Major in it, who got killed at the interval, but coming back to the soldier thing.
Yeah.
Lots of casting directors were coming round at Richmond after to see other people, but then seeing me at the stage door leaving, and going, oh, nice to see you again. You haven't forgotten how to do it, have you? And I think, no, I never forgot how to do it. You forgot to ring up. And that got, and I think actually from that I did Drop Dead Donkey, and then people started going, oh right, yeah. But of course then I was nearly 40, whereas the last time people really see me I was sort of early 30s, and you know, it was rather different. There'd been a 7-year gap.
So she was absolutely right.
She was absolutely right. And I always, and every time I tell her, I always acknowledge her. And I do remember how down I felt when she said it, but thinking, but she was so gracious, and I, you know, she had been a big star. She just had that quality about me. But yeah, who am I to refuse? And
so what was it like going from theatre to TV? Because I think a lot of actors, myself included, have that kind of worry of going on a film set or a TV set and suddenly being, if it's a bigger job, surrounded by all these people. What was it like for you to go from theatre to telly?
Well, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. And there are lots of people. I'm still not quite sure what the best boy does. I mean, I know in my own mind what he does, but I don't. On a film and television set, I've never really managed to put a task on him. It's difficult because you do feel out of your depth. And I don't think we educate people enough about that. And I know that you're thinking of doing something here in the autumn with Dennis Lawson, who's just written a brilliant book which just explains who everybody is on a set before it starts talking about how you act. Because part of the thing is, you know, when you're in an uncomfortable environment, you don't feel you can do your best. And then nobody'd actually told me about acting on television, really. I know there's a camera, and I know you weren't supposed to be as loud, evidently. And you probably shouldn't be doing that all the time. But other than that, nobody really said anything. So I thought, the camera's there, so just as if there's an audience there and you would angle this scene so that you're aware of the audience, so you angle it that you're aware of the camera. You know, you don't look at the camera, but you know where the camera is. And of course that's absolute bullshit, because you have to let the camera come and find you. And I didn't do that. There are programs going round, curse the internet. My other half did a brilliant thing for my 50th birthday several years ago now, where they found lots of old things I was in, like Tales of the Unexpected and Forever Green and All Creatures Great and Small. I don't know how anybody really employed me ever again, because it was all, you know, it was a bit big and hearty, you know. Theatre had been my training and theatre had been everything, and I could now, I don't know whether I fill a theatre. I quite like when I have to work at this volume and that thing, you know, whereas...
You like the intimacy of the TV and things.
Well, the first really big... I mean, I did lots and lots of telly when I got to about 40. I think and my attitude to telly changed because of doing something else, doing role play, which I do a lot of, and corporate stuff. And you're doing a role play with a doctor, and I didn't know anything about role play, and I was just doing it for the money. But you're with a real doctor who really believes he's telling you you've got cancer. And suddenly the fact there's four doctors there watching, they disappear, because actually this person's concentration is phenomenal. And you're only doing it for them. And that's the thing about role play. There is no element of an audience. You're only doing it for the person you're with. And you absolutely believe that this conversation just exists for you. And I was doing that, and then I remember going home on the train thinking, that must be what doing proper telly acting is like. And I think that began to infuse it. And then, because then I did Peep Show, where you have to talk down the camera all the time. And I never had a problem with that. I mean, some actors came in, used to find it really, really difficult. We'd rehearse the scene like this, and then you step out, David Mitchell steps out, they put the camera there, and David will stand there and do his lines. Or what normally happens is we have a very, very hunky cameraman called Nick, and you stand behind Nick so that you can manoeuvre Nick as to what you did in the scene. So, you know, if you look down, and Nick's brilliant at doing that. But you then have the conversation with the glass of the lens. And that to me was absolutely natural. But again, having this really quiet, focused thing.
So let's talk about the role play then. How did you get into doing that? Where did that come about?
When I was directing, I think there's still a bit of me that wanted to act in some way. And there's also the need to earn money. I was at a dinner party one night and somebody was there and said, and it came up that I was an actor. And then they went, oh, we're looking for some actors to do some funny sketches with Nick Ross. And he went, what? It's for Canon photocopiers. Give me a call. So I gave her a call and they sent some scripts. And another actress and I turned up at a conference and we did funny sketches with Nick Ross. And then you thought, this is rather nice, because, you know, it's quite well paid.
Good money, yeah.
Yeah, very good one. And then the woman who'd done this said, I don't normally deal with this type of thing, but I'll tell you who does. And I wrote to somebody who was at a company called Purchase Point and said, hello, I'm an actor. I've been told to use actors. And I didn't hear from her. And then 6 months later, she rang up and said, I'm doing something and I need an actor for a big job for Microsoft. And I went to see her and meet her producer, and I did that. And at the same time, somebody said, there's an actress called Debbie Manship who runs a company called Roll Call. You should write to her. And I thought it'd be really good, because the thing about the directing jobs, I was directing 2 or 3 plays a year, but, you know, there was time in between them when you weren't in the rehearsal room to do other things and you had to earn money. And I'm not backward at giving my opinion on anything. So role play and doing feedback came quite naturally. I mean, what it did do is that it taught me something that you don't get if you come from just outside Rotherham, which is tact. You know, I can't spell it, let alone do it. But actually having to phrase that feedback into something that helps somebody. I don't have a problem doing it as a director, because I understand where they are as an actor. So I would never, ever in a rehearsal go, that's really crap. Actually, I probably have done at times. But hopefully, with enough of a twinkle, that the actor will learn from it and they know. But giving feedback wasn't ever one of my skills. And I'm sure if you ask my other half, you'll be told that it's still not one of my skills. But professionally, because I learnt a formula to do it. And I just liked it. And it was just the right time to get into it. It was 1993, and the role play was just taking off, but there weren't many people doing it, and everybody did it but went, but if I get an acting job, that's having precedence. And because I was directing, I just went, I'm free, I'll do that, because I can move my other things around.
Do you think doing the role play improved, that made you a better actor? Do you think it helped with acting?
I think it did, in terms of this thing of understanding size of acting. To me, acting was always that size, you know, big.
Yeah.
And to understand that actually having a conversation at this sort of level is also acting. Yeah, undoubtedly. And it helped me refocus, I think.
What tips do you have for other actors that perhaps want to get into role play or do role play? Because I know you've written a book, So You Want to Be a Corporate Actor, which is available.
That's
it?
Very kind of you.
Nice little plug there for you.
Very kind. Book plug. Yeah, okay.
So you've written a book, which has got lots of helpful information in it. But if you were going to give us a tip now of how actors can get into role play, what would you suggest?
Well, I think the first thing is you've got to be in a state of mind that if it's going to be a job you're going to do, because you're not acting, but it's something to keep you going, then basically don't do it. Go and work in a wine bar or go and work in a supermarket, because there are lots of actors who do it now and they make it their job and they're committed to it and they don't cancel jobs and they work for several different role play companies and they earn a very good salary each year from doing it and they're using their skills. So you've got to make a commitment. I'm not saying you have to shut your acting work out, but I would think that if you're not doing any of it at the moment, you've got to give yourself a good period of time to say, that's what I'm going to focus on. I think you have to be... I think it's brilliant if you've got other skills. And I think the main thing is not to go in there pretending you're anything other than an actor. People go in, you know, some people go, well, I worked in an office once, so I understand office politics, so I can talk to you about performance. You're not there to provide a solution. You're there to provide what you do as an actor. And it's Hamlet, isn't it? Where hold a mirror up to nature. Is it Hamlet? Should we hold a mirror up to nature? The quote. Well, that's what you're doing as an actor. You're being the person they want to have this difficult conversation with, or the person they've got this problem to talk about, cancer or absence or whatever it is. You are that mirror that allows them to talk. So I think that's the main thing. And the other thing is you've got to be quite selfless, because it's all about them. It's no element of performance for anybody watching. There's no element of performance for them that you're doing. It's absolutely, you've got to work out what they're doing and work out what the little pokes are that you can get them to do more or let them through or whatever. But you're absolutely doing it for their benefit. Mm. And I think as actors, we're quite used to doing it for our benefit.
Yeah.
I like doing things for my benefit, and I like lots of people telling me that's really good. And actually, you can do a really brilliant morning's role play, and nobody will remember to say, you're really good. They'll go, well, well done to all the people who've taken part, and you find yourself having to do that as well in this terrible modern fashion we have where people clap themselves. I yell at the television when people do that on game shows, and they go, you know, and it's Paul Clayton. Don't clap yourself! You know. That will be in my room 101, people who clap themselves.
Okay, so let's go back. I want to talk about, you said earlier that you did 4 years without an agent.
Yeah.
4 years work. I think there's this kind of expectancy that you come out of drama school and the first thing you do is find an agent, then you get work. Do you think an agent is important, necessary, do you think? Because 4 years without.
Well, I think it's important, ultimately. I don't know whether it's necessary. I think it helps you focus what you're doing. There wasn't this same thing when I came out of drama school, which was, 1978, that what we all wanted was a job. And I think what we'd all wanted to be were actors. So you're an actor when you've got a job and you're acting and you're being paid for it. I think now I look at drama schools and I go and talk to graduates, and I've been working with the guys from the Alan Bates for the last couple of years. There's this big thing that you wanted to be an actor all your life till the age of 21, and about 4 months before the moment that you're going to do what's been your life's ambition, actually what you put all your energies into is giving all the power of your career to somebody else. I want an agent, I want an agent, I must get an agent. Oh, I failed, I haven't got an agent. Because all an agent is somebody to blame your lack of success on 3 months down the line. That's all it is. I haven't had any work, that's my agent. You wouldn't be blaming an agent if you didn't have one. You'd be taking new initiatives and doing different things. And it is difficult because now we've got into the way that casting information is disseminated and that information's held back from actors and given to agents. It makes it hard if you don't have an agent to get the right information. You know, we used to be able to write to lots of theatres knowing those letters would be read. But I think that it is important. I think a lot of people don't realise that a bad agent is worse than no agent. And if some people could see how their agents submit them, and you get an email submission and you put a brief out, which I do for corporate stuff, and then you get an email that goes, read your subs, see Steve, and there's an attachment. So I have to open the attachment, I have to look at your picture, I have to look at your CV, I have to work out from that CV why you're suitable, I have to look at what you've done that makes you suitable, and then make the decision. So that agent's not done anything. You could do that. What you would probably do is you would write an email saying, dear Paul Clayton, with regards to your corporate casting, may I submit, these are the reasons why I hope to hear from you. And you would be guided into that submission. But, you know, I think it is, there is some work you'll never see a smell of if you don't have an agent, and that's true. It was different in the late 70s and the early 80s, and I had the dream. I was in a play at Leicester Haymarket quite happily doing my thing, and another actress came in and said, showed me a postcard and said, my agent was in last night and they thought you were fantastic, look at that. And on the bottom of the postcard was just a scrawled PS to Paul Clayton, have an agent. And I'm like, oh God, no, I don't. And she was a good agent, and I rang up and went to meet her. And, and interestingly, I got an agent, and she was a really classy agent. And then I spent the longest time I've ever had out of work. Then I was out of work for 9 months, because she just changed the whole sort of métier of things I went up for. So I got down to the last two for a lead in the West End, and I got down to the last two for a telly, but I didn't get it. But I suddenly had nine, and I'd never had, you know, I'd worked for 4 years reasonably solidly with a month or 6 weeks off between theatre jobs, and then suddenly 9 months of nothing.
What are your tips in that scenario if you've got perhaps an agent that isn't getting you any work? Is there anything that you can suggest to people out there? Is there any advice when you've got an agent that you think isn't particularly pulling their weight?
Well, I think the main thing is that most actors are really afraid to stir the boat with their agent because they think that they are working for the agent. And actually not, because the agent's working for you. Mm. And of course the agent's response is, if you write and go, nothing much been happening, I'm wondering why this is, the agent's first thing will be, I think you should change your headshots, because they'll find something to blame it on. It's not your, it might be your photograph, it probably very rarely is. But, you know, it's what... Have you discussed with your agent how they see you? What they see you as? I mean, I sometimes get forwarded the brief from the Spotlight link with details of where I've got to go for a meeting, and then you scroll down the email, and there's the original link. And one came up the other week, which was a sitcom for Channel 4, for a pilot. And the description for the character was, we meet Mr. Jenkins... a brusque manner and far too many chins. So I sent an email back to my agent going, just how many chins does a role have to have before you put me up? But of course they're right, you know. That's how they see me, and they know how they sell, and I know what they sell me as, and they're imaginative, and I hope, I think they are, and they push that. But I think the main thing is that young people put everything onto getting an agent at the expense of getting a job, so that they're delaying the thing of getting a job. And I think it'd be great if an agent comes along from your showcase, it'd be really good. But they've got to want you. And I think people go a bit the other way about, you know, I'm desperate, I'm really desperate.
Okay, I'm going to hand over to our very select...
God,
audience,
right, okay.
And see if there's any questions. Straight up, there's a question.
Could you talk us through, as a solid working professional actor who's done a lot of TV, what a day is like? You know, a day like right from, you know, getting the call from the agent through to how you get to the set, what happens set before you're shooting, just through a day as a working actor on a TV set in something like, you know, the Doctors or one of these other, you know, high quality.
Okay. Right, well, it tends to start early, probably earlier than you think. It used to start with a car coming to collect you. You will now hear the phrase from your agent when you've got the role that they will have said it's non-exclusive transport, which means that...
have to make your own money.
No, it means that you'll be sharing. So it can be good sometimes because it's nice, but early in the morning, 5:30, a car coming... You don't really want, you know, the really good drivers, if you're really lucky, they know what newspaper you have. I have a brilliant driver on Peep Show who knows not what newspaper I have. He buys it from the newsagents. It's lying on the back seat. I haven't got the heart to tell him I've got it on my iPad. So I read the newspaper, get to the set. On something like a day's shooting, if it's a regular thing, so like this time last year we were doing Him and Her, and we were all there most days because of the nature of the programme. You will get on set and rehearse quite quickly. Sometimes, if it's something really big, I've just finished doing Wolf Hall for the BBC, you'll go straight into makeup and you'll spend a considerable amount of time in there. Then you'll be taken out to the set to rehearse. Then while they set up that, you'll go back, finish makeup, costume, or invariably what I do is go back and sleep in my trailer, and my other half tweets very annoyingly that, you know, but the first thing you do in your working day is have an hour's sleep. And then you're on the set. And how you use that time is up to you. Most people I do that, and then over here I'm quite happy to chat. Some people like to stay with it in the zone, and only chat when you're back at base or back off location. It depends, and you have one. That's one of the key things, is just respecting, I think, and judging how different people like to work. And it's really difficult to do, because I've just worked with Mark Rylance, who I think obviously is one of the greatest actors we've got. And on my very first day, it was a scene between me and him, and the director on Wolf Hall was very keen that we rehearsed it, almost like you'd rehearse a theatre scene. So we spent a television rehearsal can be 5 minutes. Most directors in television, they mean, do the lines, we'll tell you where to stand. You may come up with, would I say this, or would, but they're not really interested because they're looking for their shots. But Peter Kosminski was fantastic. We rehearsed for 40 minutes with the entire crew stood around, and we worked out every permutation of how far I would go to him before I bowed, or whether he would bow to me, and who would extend a hand. And you think Mark is, and there's just an intensity about him. So you don't necessarily go and chat with somebody once you're waiting. Actually, I then found out he's got a fantastic twinkle, and we spent most of our time off the set playing a little game called Pocket, which involves wooden discs and elastics, and it's fantastic, great fun. So I think it's respecting how other people work. You eat a big lunch, don't have the pudding because you'll get a sugar low in the middle of the afternoon. The thing that people remember is when you've had an early start, it feels like you've done a really long day by the time you get to lunch. But actually, you will probably shoot more stuff after lunch. So you'll do more in the second half of the day than you've already done. And there's sometimes a big temptation to go, oh, fill up, relax, whatever. And then actually you look and think, actually, we've still got 6 hours to do. And it's, I think the most important thing is pacing yourself. And then coming home, you get, you know, they peel you into a car, or you get brought home, or sometimes now they do take you to the nearest station, and that can add a lot to your day. So it varies on set. Is that
yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah, it was a good question.
Anyone else?
Just wondering, I've never done any corporate role play stuff, and you said if it's not something you're really wanting to do, leave it. But how do you kind of find out if you want to do it? Test the waters.
That's a very good question. I do some courses here. I don't do them very often. I'm really thrilled when people who come and they say their intention from the day is just to find out whether it's something that suits them. I mean, you know, I didn't ever, as part of my, 17, 16-year-old self thinking I want to be an actor, I didn't think that involved sitting in training rooms with men in chinos and polo shirts, driving Ford Maestros, talking about key performance indicators. But actually, it does, and it's given me an enormous amount of financial freedom to choose work, rather than have to do everything that comes in. And there were things I didn't know, like you've seen, I didn't know I have the ability to be quite patient with absolute dickheads in the right situation. And that's normally when the fee is written on my wrist here.
Oh, good. That's a good tip.
I've done that. I mean, I've done really boring jobs where you have to learn an 18-page script about digital media transfer. I know that gets you quite excited. But this was several years ago at a conference, at an exhibition in Amsterdam, and I was going to be on a stand doing 14 shows a day about a thing called Kahuna, a digital media editing suite. And I was stood there, and I was allowed cue cards. And I have to look really good and get the people. And they're all, you know, they're all these men watching this thing, and there's not much natural fibre in the room. You know, peering out, being really excited. And you do a show every half an hour, 14-minute show every half an hour from 9:30 or 10 through till 5, and you get an hour for lunch if you're lucky. And that's hard work. You write your fee, which should be four figures at the very least on here. And then as you're about to take a deep breath and start going, so ladies and gentlemen, I'm here today to talk to you about possibly the biggest advance in digital media transfer that you will have seen in the last 4 years. That is the Big Kahuna. The great thing.
That's good.
So, funnily enough, when I come and work here, my fee's never written on my wrist.
No, I can't say it. Good question.
But I would come and do a course here, or at the very least, some of the really good roleplay agencies like Steps do have a sort of workshop audition that you could go along to, and you could learn quite a lot from that. And you can buy my book, which is a shameless plug. And I think you get it cheaper here than anywhere else, because I think we've done a deal here. And hopefully it's an entertaining read. It's fun. And it doesn't just look at role play. It does look at promotions. I'm going to have lunch with somebody when I finish this who's head of a brilliant promotions company called Crew Live. And we've been letting actors from the Actors Centre, putting them in touch with them to do stuff. It pays reasonably well. It does use your acting skills. You're working with like-minded people. And we're getting involved with them, because I'm very keen that what we do here should relate to work. I'm sure Meisner is a fantastic technique. I've never done it. I can't understand the point of sitting in a dark room doing Meisner all afternoon, because my thing would be, do I get a job out of doing Meisner? Because ultimately that's why I act. I act to live. I don't necessarily live to act.
Okay. Any more questions? Yeah.
How do you deal with the periods when you are resting?
I'm really bad, and it never gets any easier. The first day I love it. The second day I like being at home, but I'm thinking about what I'm doing. And the third day I am then absolutely impossible to deal with. I find that you have to have objectives. When I had my very first period of unemployment, somebody said to me, what are you going to do next week? And I went, I don't have a job. And they said, that wasn't the question. What are you going to do next week? I went, I don't know what you mean. Well, you have to have something you're going to achieve with next week. So I gave up sugar in tea and coffee, because I used to have four sugars in a tea and four sugars in a coffee.
Wow.
So my task was on that Monday morning was to have a cup of tea and not have any sugar. And you know, you're supposed to treat it as not that it's a tea without sugar, but that it's a new drink. I did it, and that was my task. And it took me about 10 days until I could pick up a cup of tea or coffee without thinking, this hasn't got sugar in it. I'm thinking, I don't really notice. But it was something in my life that I was trying to achieve. And I was given a piece of advice by a drama school tutor, which I have stuck by, and I think it's possibly the best piece of advice I've ever been given, which is do one thing each day that might lead to work, and then get on with living your life. Because otherwise your life becomes about not being an actor. But actually you're a person for the whole of the rest of that day. And what will get you the job in the interview room is the person you are, not the actor. When you get in for an audition, competency is assumed. The casting director hasn't put five people in front of the director, four of whom who can't act and one who can. She's put five people she thinks could play the role. So it will be all the things other than your acting that will engage with the director. And those are the things that you bring uniquely as the person you are to that situation. So it's really important to do that. So I write now, and in fact I'm writing a new book, which is about, I suppose a lot of that, it's about all the things other than the acting that you have to do. It's called The Working Actor. It's about making meetings work, making interviews work, about how you choose your headshots, about how you work with your agent, about how you work without an agent, how you use the casting services, doing your tax, how you claim benefits, what apps there are for actors that can make your life easier, how to cope with the blues. But it is to do with a frame of mind. And I think all it is you're still an actor in that time. It's just that you're not doing acting. You're focusing your energies in a different way. I'm going to have to say it doesn't get easier. But I think because you've, like anything that you've done more, you deal with it more easily.
Okay, that's a good answer. Okay, we'll have one more question. Anyone? Last one.
You might not.
We might. What
you might find is that moment that the interviewer faces when you will have one more question. No, look, there are you.
Oh, there we go.
You've
saved us.
Yeah, lovely listening to you
all.
Thank you very much. Now, you're going on to something else. Are you going to be doing, still doing the interviewing, but somewhere else?
I am, that's almost a plug for your end bit, really,
yes,
isn't it? I'm taking this to Drury Lane,
yes,
this format, because my partner is the commercial director for Really Useful Theatres. The Theatre Royal Drury Lane is possibly one of the most beautiful, it's certainly one of the most beautiful Georgian buildings that we have. And Andrew Weber, who owns it, is very annoyed that it stands empty all day till 7 o'clock at night. Prime real estate in Covent Garden. They've just opened up the terrace. It's frightfully expensive, but the Tattinger Terrace, now sponsored by Tattinger, to get people to use the building in the day. And they're going to try out a series of free events called Lunchtime at the Lane. And we said we would provide three off the records. So it'll be a lunchtime thing. We're still keeping the booking in-house, so there will be priority for members. It will be open to the public. There'll be a capacity of about 150 people. I'm doing one in September with Alex Jennings, who is playing Willy Wonka at the moment. And Alex and I have known each other since we were 16. And then I'm doing Zoe Wanamaker. And then either Mark Rylance or Kevin Spacey, whichever one of them can pull their finger out first, in early December. And that's just so that it also helps raise the profile of what we do here at the Actor Centre. And the brilliant thing is that we're not going to lose it here, because Steve's going to carry it on here. And we'll come back and we'll swap and change. But Steve will be carrying them on here with other actors, because we're dependent on people's generosity to come and give up an hour of their time and talk. And we've been really lucky so far with the people who've done it.
So you don't get paid for it?
No. No, we don't get paid for anything. I joined the board of the Actors Centre 5-6 years ago because somebody thought my corporate knowledge about how actors work in that business would be really good, and the Actors Centre never ever asked a single thing about it. And I got to the point where I was about to leave the board, and then Matthew Lloyd was about to leave, and something happened that made me think, right, and I spoke at a board meeting about, why does this place have the right to have money? Why? Why do actors think they have... You know, we're in a climate where hospitals are being closed, libraries are being closed, people can't get to see a GP. Quite frankly, if a big chasm opened up down the length of the country tonight and every single actor fell down it and it closed, there'd be a collective tut from the British public at 7:30 when the Queen Vic was empty, and then they'd get on with their lives and we would not be missed. We are a luxury. We do brilliant things. We enhance people's soul. We make them look at themselves. But we're not a necessity. And so people in this building here going, it's the Actors Centre. We should be given money so we can find ourselves on a Thursday afternoon. It's a pile of shite. The reason this building will work is because it's got to be associated with people who are here who want to go out and do work. And workshops in this building should be about that. It should be a bridge between actors and the world of work. It should not be a club for out-of-work actors. It should have a mix of people from all aspects of the profession. And that's what I want to do. I haven't come here to be liked. And I know in certain quarters here I'm not popular. I don't give a shit, quite frankly. Because when I'm not chairman in 5 years or so, I would like to think, well, it was there and it's now here. And if some people respect what I've done, that's all you can ask for. But we don't get paid, and we have a brilliant board, and we've got some new people on it who I brought in. Some people in their 20s, heaven forfend. because I think they probably have the better ideas than people like me. And it is a really valuable resource. And we've got this fantastic building here in Covent Garden. And I know when I'm on a set and I say to actors, and they go, and I go, I'm the chairman of the Actors' Centre, and they go, oh, the Actors' Centre, that's fantastic, isn't it? Where is it again? They don't have a clue, because they're working, so they don't come here. So that's what we have to do, and connect it to the world of work. And people like Steve and people and our staff here work really hard at doing that. But it's an uphill struggle. You know, we have what, barely 2,000 members, and and there are 60,000 people in Spotlight. So we ain't doing brilliantly, but we're very proud of the members we have, and we think they'd have a better experience if there were more of them.
Okay. Well, I think that's a good.
That was a bit of a polemic, wasn't it?
Wasn't it?
Yeah, sorry about that. That answer will be published as a pamphlet.
Yes.
And sent out.
Well, thank you for your time this afternoon, Paul. We appreciate that. And thank you, everyone, for coming. I think there's an opportunity as you leave to give a small or a large donation to the Actors' Centre, as it would be appreciated. As Paul said, we'll be back in the autumn doing talks here and at the Theatre World Jubilee. And just one more time for Paul Clayton.